From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. On today's show, we remember the late filmmaker and feminist Agnès Varda, a giant of French cinema gone at age 90. And then, an experimental stage adaptation of Joan Didion's explosive essay, The White Album, performed by actress Mia Baron.
I thought of what she created as a character, of someone who is in control in some ways because of her powers of language and observation, who yet is able to describe her total lack of control.
And later, we'll meet the archival producer who's become known as the Indiana Jones of jazz. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. We woke today to learn that Agnès Varda had died. The 90-year-old filmmaker, closely associated with the French New Wave, found new fans in 2017 when she made the documentary Faces Places with the young muralist known as J.R. And here they are getting settled on the mics for an interview back then with our own John Horn.
Hi.
Hello, Agnès. How are you today? I'm going to be the interviewer. Agnès, how was your childhood? When was your first kiss and where?
Oh, my God. Dear John, I hope we can speak about other things.
I think we should speak about JR. Ask JR about his first kiss and his childhood.
Varda was a celebrated filmmaker well before Faces Places. Over a 60-year career, she made more than 50 feature films, shorts, and documentaries. For a time, she lived in California, though Varda never went Hollywood. In 2017, she was awarded an honorary Lifetime Achievement Oscar. In Faces Places, we ride along with J.R. and Varda in a van across the French countryside as they banter and create massive photographic portraits of everyday people, which were then plastered on the sides of buildings.
We were meeting people. We met people who had no power. J.R. would do big images to make them big in the villages. And we thought that listening to them carefully gives them the right to speak, brings to the audience the impression that they have met these people. We were like go-between, so that the audience, we would start to love the people, and we discover them, we learn about them. I think, even though we are a funny couple, but we are the go-between, we should be erased of the story. You know, the story is between the people we filmed and the audience.
JR, would you say, over the course of working on this project with Agnès, that you discovered that you have much more in common as visual storytellers than a lot of people would assume at the beginning of the story?
I knew Agnès' work before we started working together, but we had never met. When we met, we find so many others point in common. Like, for example, we don't work with brands. Agnès don't do advertising. I don't do advertising. We're really independent in the way we're working. We have that in common. In the way we highlight only anonymous people, we also have that in common. So basically, very quickly, we forgot about our age difference and we worked as two artists and friends and, you know, we're buddies, even if we have 55 years different. Now, I don't agree with Agnès on one thing, because the film is also about our relation. And there's a bit of that, because one of the things that I had loved doing in the film was to understand what Agnès is seeing. Because one of the story of the film is that she's losing slowly her eyesight, and I'm trying to envision what she see. And slowly, in between the travel, she let me, you know, follow her vision and try to understand it in a metaphorical way. And that's for me some of my favorite scenes in the film also, because we're communicating with art and images and people.
It doesn't matter if I see well or not, you know. I'm slightly out of focus and I see J.R. facing me, taking his iPhone to take a picture of me. Gets on my nerves, my dear. Stop. Mm-hmm.
JR, in the film, you photograph a young woman who works at a cafe in a small village. And after you take her picture, you paste her photo on the side of a wall. And she talks about how she feels uncomfortable that people are taking her photo, that it's so big. Do you see people kind of having a different experience once they see themselves kind of blown up? And maybe this is true of you, Agnès, as well. The way you look at yourself when other people are looking at an image of yourself.
That waitress, she accepted. And then later we kept what she said, that she felt a little unease because she's shy, and people take her picture and send it over the net, you know, over the web. But then she's proud because her kids says she's beautiful. So it's a mixed feeling, and we kept it because she was the only one who reacted not totally positive. But it was fair to let it happen, to let her speak about that.
You know, not everyone wants to have his photo on a giant wall. And that's interesting. This waitress, she said yes right away when we did it, but we remember she was shy. And of course, when we saw her after the summer and asked her for questions, then she said, look, I was the center of attention for the whole summer, and I realized, you know, that's not what I like to be.
Agnes, I want to ask you about a scene toward the end of the film where you go to try to visit Jean-Luc Godard, and let's just say he's not a gentleman. Did you say to JR, why don't we do a big photograph that we can paste over Jean-Luc Godard's house and maybe embarrass him that way?
No, it was not a project at all. I wanted to make him meet JR, and JR meet Jean-Luc, because JR said, oh, I'd love, you know Godard, I'd love to meet him. Like,
because you kept telling me that he had sunglasses like me, but I didn't know he would be yeah. such a,
and
a
I,
not nice man.
I remind him that in 61 when I filmed him.
Yeah, because, but I don't tell the end of the film, yes.
No. But wait a minute, are you? The film has opened now.
Yeah, but still, you cannot say what happened at the end of the film.
You're right.
You know, that's part
you're
of the
right.
concept why so people go to see it in cinema.
I was disappointed.
And
Jeb became very nice to me, which was not
okay,
always.
Okay, so you know at the end of the film that I become nice to her,
yeah, because
which might intend that the whole film I'm not nice to
no,
you. Is that
you
what
were
you're saying?
Putting me down all the time.
Oh, no, I was not. Come on.
No. Well, in a way, I felt... You felt that I was too small, too old.
Yeah, but isn't that true?
Yes, it's true.
So.
You guys are such a great couple. And Agnes, how did you get JR to take off his sunglasses? Because I know he's wearing them right now.
He wears them all the time, but not when we are together. When we have dinner with friends and family, he's just a normal guy. Huh? But this is his costume. Costume is a black hat and black glasses. My costume is two-color hairdo. So I cannot complain that he wants to have a special type that people recognize him. But it's a joke, you know. The whole thing is not serious. Our couple was sort of funny for people to watch. We're comrades. That's what I felt we are.
Agnes and JR, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, thank you.
Bonjour, au revoir.
Coming up on The Frame, a classic Joan Didion essay gets its stage debut. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Joan Didion's essay, The White Album, is coming to the stage in an adaptation created by multimedia director Lars Jahn. The White Album ricochets between historic moments Didion witnessed in the 1960s, stoned-out recording sessions with The Doors, encounters with Black Panther leader Huey Newton, and her own struggles with paranoia and depression. For the theatrical adaptation, Obie Award winner Mia Barron performs the text in its entirety, flanked by an ensemble cast that includes both trained actors and audience members. When Barron and director Lars Jahn came by the studio, I asked him to explain why he felt compelled to bring Didion's essay to the stage.
In terms of her writing of it, it feels a little bit like sleight of hand. It's not totally clear what she's doing. So just as an artist, as a writer, as a person who likes to structure things and thinks about form as it relates to revealing content, which is this chaotic time in the 60s, to me, it has an impact on me like the best fiction does. And I suppose it feels most relevant to me now or in the last maybe 5 or 6 years, especially the upheaval in the country, the exposure of the tensions. Those tensions have obviously always been there, but I grew up in the 80s and I just was not aware of how raw and how wide the rift was until more recently. And to me, having not lived through the 60s, it feels resonant with what people express about that time. Me and I are partners and we've been together for 9 years now, almost 10 years. But it wasn't until partway into our relationship and I'd seen me act a few times, I thought, oh, actually, I really want to work on this visual idea, which I've had for many years, because now I found the person who could play that character.
Well, the White Album famously begins with the line,
"We tell ourselves stories in order to live."
Mia, what does that line mean to you as an actress, as an artist?
To me, the essay has both hope and despair in equal measure and is somewhat of a Rorschach, depending on what you internally contain. And I think that line does as well have both hope and despair. You know, the paradoxical nature of... we need these stories in order to survive in order to make sense of our world. And making art is an act of fortitude and beauty to create something out of these stories. And then the other side of that is the futility and the senselessness around us and how delusional it is to think that there is an inherent story there with sense, and that what we do as humans is to compile these things and desperately grab at some sort of sense. And I believe both those things, depending on the hour. And I find the essay to be very incredibly alive in that juxtaposition. And she's recounting, she's writing several years after this moment, which is interesting.
She's almost like 10 years removed from the actual events.
Yes. So she's survived it. She has managed to come out of it using words to tell some kind of story about it, even though in the events that she's talking about, she is feeling that the words are almost arbitrary, and yet she needs them so much. So it's a fascinating tightrope she's on in that moment in her life.
Mm. You know, your staging, Lars, of the White Album is, to me, pretty unconventional, but in a good way. Starting at the beginning, you have the actors kind of milling around, and as I was watching, I didn't quite know what was happening. And then I saw, okay, these people are actors, this is the audience, and it created this kind of blur between audience and actor. Tell me what effect you were going for there.
So right away, I think there's something that's unstable about the beginning of the piece, because when you walk into the theater, there are already about 25 people on the stage, and it's not totally clear what they're doing. And actually, they're a second audience. They've come to the theater earlier, and we've shared a meal with them, and we've started a conversation with them, and then they walk on a stage and they put on in-ear monitors and they start receiving instructions. So by the time that I call it the outer audience, the traditional audience that's sitting in the theater, by the time they enter into the house to find their seats, the inner audience, which is mostly composed of young people in their 20s, mostly students, mm-hmm. they're an hour and a half into a different version of the same show. The experiences of the two audiences are interlocking and influence one another. But a key difference is that the inner audience is on stage and eventually enters into this structure, this beautiful aesthetic object that reminds me of kind of different eras of California architecture, and also Joan Didion's house in Malibu. One of the genesises for the piece is that I had a very small visual idea of basically Joan Didion in her house in Malibu at a party, sliding open a glass door, walking onto the deck and looking out at the ocean and starting to talk. And the party just goes on behind her.
We're talking with Lars Jahn, director of The White Album, and with actress Mia Baron. Well, let's hear an excerpt from The White Album, and it's when Joan Didion drops into a recording session in Los Angeles by Jim Morrison and The Doors. And I think the first voice we'll hear is of one of our guests, Mia Baron, as Joan Didion.
The curious aspect of Morrison's arrival was this. No one acknowledged it. Robbie Krieger continued working out a guitar passage. John Densmore tuned his drums. Manzarek sat at the control console and twirled a corkscrew and let a girl rub his shoulders. The girl did not look at Morrison, although he was in her direct line of sight. An hour or so passed, and still no one had spoken to Morrison. Then Morrison spoke to Manzarek. He spoke in an almost whisper, as if he were wresting the words from behind some disabling aphasia.
It's an hour to West Covina,
he said.
I was thinking we should spend the night out there after we play.
So Mia, did you approach this performance as if you were stepping into the role of Didion herself, or were you going for something else?
No, I think that would have been too, she's such an iconic figure to so many people, and I am not her, and I'm not a mimic in any way. But too, I think we needed the freedom of creation that went beyond just a straight enactment. But, you know, the character is her in some way. It's of her mind. It's her creation, and it's her voice, and it's very personal. She talks very confessionally about her sense of disorientation, depression, anxiety, and her kind of mental breakdown during those years. So it is her and it's not. It is also something she wrote and constructed for this essay, and she's also in control of her voice. And as with all stories, it's a section of her. So that just sort of gave us the ability to just be as true to that voice and that text as possible. When it came down to actually rehearsing it, I thought of what she created as a character, and of someone who is both in control in some ways because of her powers of language and observation, and of someone who yet is able to describe her total lack of control.
Well, let's actually hear from Joan Didion herself. And this is an excerpt from the Netflix biopic, The Center Will Not Hold. And it was made by Griffin Dunn, who is Joan Didion's nephew-in-law. And this is where Joan Didion is talking about the era that inspired the White Album.
I was doing a piece in the Haight-Ashbury in 1967. And it seemed to me that we were seeing the tip of something important that wasn't about quote-unquote hippies, you know, that it was about disaffected children, etc.
So, Lars, tell me what you think when you're hearing Joan Didion there.
I think the time period that she's talking about is this essay, Slouching Towards Bethlehem, which is this other masterpiece that she wrote. And she's writing about, you might call it the underbelly. So I think that, you know, the underbelly of a dimension of the culture at that moment, so that the culture was fascinated by hippies and dropping out and long hair and, you know, free love. That's where everybody was focused. And she's looking off in the corner at the two-year-old who's on acid. So her ability to, first of all, look away from the bright, shiny thing that everybody else is distracted by and look at the other dimensions of the byproducts.
Right. You know, what message or feeling do you hope people walk out of the theater with? We'll start with you, Mia.
For me, actually performing it, I feel like the communal experience of understanding what it is to feel frightened, to feel like things don't make sense, to feel like you're in a political moment where the unimaginable has happened, sitting in that together as a performer, as an audience, within the great voice of Didion articulating those feelings is extremely not only thought-provoking but cathartic, because I think a lot of people feel that way now, as do I. So the piece is not meant to be a piece of agitprop. It's not meant to say, like, this is how we move forward. I think it's meant for us to, in communion, in community of different ages, different races, different experiences, sit together with that knowledge and allow it to spark some empathetic thoughtfulness. We don't have many places to do that anymore.
And Lars?
I like her answer.
Well, thanks for being here.
Copy paste. The performance concludes with an open forum conversation where those two audiences that I mentioned before actually get to talk to each other along with the creative team. That conversation at the end of the piece is, well, what about 2068? What about 2069? Let's just have a conversation about what we think the next 50 years looks like and whether there's anything that we can take about navigating those 50 years, either from the beautiful mind of Joan Didion and also to recognize what stories we're telling ourselves and thereby what we're ignoring as a result. So how do we widen our view?
Lars Jahn is the director of The White Album, based on the Joan Didion essay of the same name, and Mia Baron performs the text on stage. Thank you both so very much for coming by.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The White Album will be performed April 5th through 7th at UCLA's Froud Theater. Coming up on The Frame, meet the Indiana Jones of jazz.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. Coming up next week on the show, the Aretha Franklin documentary Amazing Grace, shot in 1972 in Los Angeles, is finally coming to theaters. And the comedy Fresh Off the Boat hits the magic 100 episodes. And now, Resonance Records has earned a reputation for unearthing lost jazz recordings. Much of the credit goes to Zev Feldman. He's become known as the Indiana Jones of jazz. He's co-president of Resonance Records and a consulting producer at Blue Note Records. Feldman's recent discoveries include sessions by legendary figures like guitarist Wes Montgomery, saxophonist Eric Dolphy, and pianist Bill Evans. The Frame's Jonathan Shiflett visited Feldman at his studio recently to find out more.
I think what got me hooked on the rediscovery of tapes, archival recordings, has just been a personal thirst of knowledge. I was a very awkward young man when I was in my teens. I tell people this, I didn't go to my prom. I stayed home and I listened to Miles Davis. So 17 years of my career, I didn't do production. I was a sales and marketing guy. I was also a merchandiser. I hung posters for the record company in stores, would crawl around on my hands and knees, upstocking product, making displays, doing marketing. And then back around 2010, George Klaibman, he said, I'll tell you what, here's what I'm going to do. If you can go out and you can find some music that I like, and it's important and it's never been out before, I'll tell you what, you can produce it for me. And that became like fire on gasoline. I started taking every bit of bandwidth that I had to making phone calls to families of artists who had never heard from me before. Hey, do you have any tapes? Eric Dolphy contributed a great deal to jazz music. This suitcase of tapes that had been left for his friends Hale and Juanita for the safekeeping while he was away.
Let me ask you something. What's it like to go back and listen to this music all these years later?
It's familiar and it's interesting, you know, and it brings back a lot of memories.
These recordings are the first official newly unearthed studio recordings to come out in over 32 years. He was only 36 years old when he died back in 1964.
I'm just so sorry his life was cut short because he was onto something. He really was.
When you listen to Juanita Smith tell her account of him, it's just something that tugged at my heartstrings even. He was a friend. He was a musician.
He was one of the nicer people. He didn't have anything negative to say about anything. So now what else can I tell you?
Oh, man, this is so... You are doing fantastic. You are giving us gold.
Okay.
You know, I have to say, in the case of Eric Dolphy, it wasn't about having previously unissued music. It was about having great music that had never been out before. I've had some pretty deep, super overwhelming experience, almost like a blackout moment. I think the first time happened to me when I was about maybe 12 or 13 years old, and I was on the school bus. When I heard the Clash's first record, I forgot everything going on around me. I just felt suddenly numb. I just felt this powerful, like something like, you know, it got going through your bloodstream all of a sudden. It was amazing. Anyways, I've just been lucky. I've like been exposed to all sorts of music, so I feel things. And one of these examples is something that I heard a few years ago. I was contacted by a gentleman, and he was in the inner circle of Bill Evans in Europe, and he was a collector, and he had some tapes, and they were recordings of the Bill Evans Trio recorded in 1969 at the Ronnie Scott's Club in London. I want to play you this version of Our Love Is Here to Stay. First of all, this was like a trio of warriors communicating in music. And for Bill Evans, being a guy who was the leader of the trio, there was no ball hogging going on. They are passing it around. They are really incredibly connected telepathically with each other. And what you're going to hear is this track. You're going to hear Bill Evans play the introduction. It's going to go right into an Eddie Gomez bass solo. He's going to come out of this solo, and then you're all of a sudden going to hear this sort of shift, this change going back and forth. And then all of a sudden, it's like we're all going to start levitating and floating to the ceiling. Are you feeling what I'm feeling? Heart just totally stopped when I listened to this, and it was like that is one of those moments, and to be in that room was just what a remarkable thing it must have been to be there, but to have these recordings now I hope your listeners enjoy. To me, it's one of those moments.
And that's The Frame for this week. The show's produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, Julia Paskin, Andrea Gutierrez, and Paul Ratliff. Our engineer is Valentino Rivera. I'm Stephen Cuevas. John Horn is back Monday. Have a great weekend.